Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, where we bring you all the news and views from this week in media. Peter, where is Chris this week? Because I can't pronounce it.
Well, he's in France, and we thought maybe he was in Cannes. But no, he's in Valence-sur-Bey, which is Midi-Pyrénées. I don't know, he's somewhere in France. He was on a boat complaining about having no pizza, but, you know, he's not here. The most important point is he's not here, so...
So while he's been on a boat with a hat with Dubrovnik written on it in the middle of France, what have you been up to?
This week I spoke to Rosie Fletcher, UK editor for Denner Geek. We spoke about the mainstreaming of geek culture, finding an angle for entertainment stories that everyone else is covering, and how to maintain a friendly online community.
But before that, as always, we've got the news roundup. Yeah, I think the first thing on this is that a new app has launched and it's offering content from the FT, Bloomberg and The Economist. This is not Apple News.
How much is it though?
How much is everything these days?
It's got to be $9.99. There must be a focus group somewhere that just anyone asks them how much is something, they just go, oh, $9.99.
It's like the subscription equivalent of Poundland, isn't it? Everything's $9.99.
Yeah. Anyway, so what do you get for your $9.99?
Well, you get access to Mogul News, which allegedly is going to offer access to the world's best journalism in one app, which I think translates to basically the Britain's best journalism. I mean, this is literally just featuring stuff from Financial Times, Bloomberg and The Economist, all of which have their own kind of really hefty subscription packages themselves.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
So my question to this is, what have they offered these three publishers to get access to this content?
So I don't know these guys, Mogul News, are they new?
Their founder, Rav Singh Sangu, launched Market Mogul, which was supposed to be like a media website on finance and business. Mm. And like he raised a ton of money for that last year, but then he's almost changed tactic and taken that money and has used it to develop this, it's almost like a mini aggregator app, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what I think's interesting, I mean, it's many because at the minute there's three publishers, I guess. But what's interesting is there's actually human beings choosing the story rather than algorithms, which I don't know how scalable that is as a model, but it's interesting.
I can't get my head around how any of those three publishers would agree to this, because they can't be getting that much. Like, I'd love to know how much of that $9.99 they get. Which, I mean, it's probably more than they get from Apple News. But it seems like this Mogul News app is doing a 7 a.m. breakfast briefing with the top 5 to 7 stories of the day. And that's literally exactly what The Economist's standalone Espresso app does.
Yeah, Espresso,
and you can get that app for like £1 a week.
What, but he crowdfunded this, right?
Yeah, he's raised almost $750,000 through crowdfunding.
I think you're right. I think the FT and The Economist in particular have got to have much better distribution networks than this guy. I mean, Bloomberg has too, but maybe not in the UK. But I would have thought the FT's, you know, well, we know what the FT's got. It's got a million subscribers.
Well, I suppose the other thing is, if you're looking to subscribe to an aggregator app, you've got your $9.99 and you've got a choice between this and Apple News Plus, which does contain some content from these publishers. I'm kind of curious as to why you go for this one over... I suppose this is probably more specialist financial and business analysis.
I think this is maybe one of those ideas that's been built off the pivot to paid, and everyone's going, oh, we'll put money in a paid news service. Not everyone's going to win, which is a good segue.
It's a good segue. Do you want to take us through this next one?
This week has seen... Actually, this week saw a couple of things. One was Mary Meeker. Digital report, which... I really just couldn't bring myself to care.
What, you mean you didn't fancy going through all the 333 slides?
You know what? I didn't even want to read the takes on it because it's the same stuff. Did you read it? I avoided it.
No, I didn't read it. I think it was a choice between reading that and the digital news report.
Right, and that is way more interesting. So this week, the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism came out with their digital news report 2019. I don't know, last week's canary in the coal mine chat that we had about micropayments, I think it's totally borne out by what they've said in the, what Reuters has said in this digital news report. Basically, Matthew Ingram did a brilliant take on this for the Columbia Journalism Review, and you know, he's basically saying, if you're a news organization and you've got your shit together and you already have a subscription base and the infrastructure in place, you're fine, you'll be doing okay. If you are a print based or print heavy publisher, smaller maybe, and you're still relying on that but trying to get into paid digital subscriptions, be screwed. He doesn't say that, but that's the implication of this report. It really is that we are at the point where the pivot to paid is starting to come up against a brick wall, I think.
Yeah, it's almost like between the lines. It was almost like everybody who's going to pay for news is paying for news.
But also, didn't it kind of peg it at one subscription?
Yeah, well, it's they survey like something like 75,000 people in almost 40 countries for this. And their key takeaway for this was that no matter how rich and educated you are, no matter how much disposable income you have to spend on this stuff, and even if you're a real news junkie, most people are only paying for one subscription. There's like a really cool chart with it that we'll include in the newsletter, but it's just like, yeah, it's not difficult to convince people to pay for one subscription, but to convince them to pay for two, three, four or five is not happening at all.
But, you know, this goes, we quote this all the time, but doesn't this go back to what Chris Duncan? Doesn't this go back to what he said about there being 10 world news brands that people will pay for, and after that it's going to become niche? And actually, this is what one of us, you or me, said last week, that people will pay for one news subscription and one niche passion subscription, and that's kind of it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this survey was very much focused on news brands, so like it's not included that passion subscription as much. Yeah, but I guess that's the wall. That's the glass paywall we've got to get through.
It's the paywall.
Yeah. Although the other thing I did find really interesting is that the Trump bump, which was kind of, it was widely talked about but not really evidenced much, that has actually had when you look back on the figures, that's had a real noticeable effect in convincing US readers to actually sign up for news brands. So the average number of people that sign up is normally, it's about 1 in 10 people sign up for a subscription across other countries. And that was the same in the US. But from 2017, that bumped up to 16% of people in the US paying for news. And that's actually remained really steady. So that, I think, is interesting. And that's a nice takeaway.
So there's that 5% that shit show that is Trump has actually spurred on to spend money. What about Brexit? No. Any mention of Brexit?
Yes, there was a mention of Brexit. 58% of British people are fed up of it and have therefore tuned out of the news.
So bad news is good news until it's bad news. The other thing I thought was weird in this was the mention of news sharing in private WhatsApp groups.
This is dark social.
Oh, this confuses me. I don't know, maybe I'm too old for this. So how does that work? I've got a group on WhatsApp, my friends or my family or whatever it is. I find an article, whatever it is, on the BBC website or the Guardian website or the Times website, whatever it is, and I share it through WhatsApp.
I mean, we do this in our podcast chat. We'll share interesting articles.
Yeah, but we're kind of weird.
No, it's apparently become like a really common thing. So whereas people used to post or share articles on their Facebook wall, instead they'll do it in a private chat group.
Is this to avoid the madness or the...
Yeah, basically.
Right.
But this creates a real problem for publishers because that kind of sharing doesn't show up on Google Analytics dashboards. So it'll show that somebody has read that article, but you have no idea where they've come from or how it's been shared. And of course, it's a lot more difficult to combat disinformation in WhatsApp groups.
Oh, the world is just on fire, isn't it, really? But not at the BBC.
No.
Because they're leveraging their podcasts into TV shows.
This is a really odd one, and it's taken me a while to get my head around what they're actually doing. But the BBC's Brexit Cast podcast is making its TV debut in September. It won the Listener's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. So it's a really popular podcast for all the people that aren't switching off news in the UK. Yeah, and they've been given a slot on BBC One late on Thursday nights just to do it.
Or is that after the question time slot?
But I think it's going to be quite interesting to see how you take the transition from being a podcast and primarily about voice to having that on camera.
I mean, there's so many podcasts on making it across to TV, but most of them are like kind of dramas or documentaries.
Yeah, there was the Wolverine podcast that made it back into a comic that Marvel Studios are doing.
But I don't know, the world, the media snake is clearly eating its own tail, so we just need to keep an eye on that one. So, in brief this week, Axel Springer is merging Business Insider and market researcher eMarketer next year. That's kind of weird. They do very different things.
The thing I find funniest about the article promoting this is that they describe Business Insider as a millennial business platform. In other news in brief, if you believe any numbers from Facebook anymore, they've managed to double the numbers on their watch platform, which is like their video streaming tab, to 140 million daily viewers, which sounds impressive, but that's only actually about 6% of their total active 2.68 billion users. But only about a third of the shows that they had with publishers are having their funding renewed. So fun is with this, Facebook this week.
Can we watch?
Yeah, watch rolled out in August.
Oh, really?
Yeah, rolled out to Europe in August. If you go on Facebook, it's like one of the... If you go on desktop, it's one of the tabs down the side.
So the fact that I don't even know it's there, but whether that says anything about me, which it probably does, it would suggest that Facebook is probably not doing a brilliant job pushing that.
Well, it also depends on what they count as you watching something in watch.
Oh, no. Really? So, it depends on Facebook deciding what numbers to use?
So, Facebook classify a viewer, an active viewer, as somebody who's watched 60 seconds of video footage. That doesn't have to be 60 consecutive seconds. You could scroll past 60 videos on your feed that are auto-playing, and you count as an active viewer. There's not much indication about whether these are people going and watching videos in the watch tab or whether that's just watching videos in the news feed. I mean, obviously, as always, they only share what they want to. So,
yay, Facebook! In other news, Snapchat has managed to double its downloads in May to 41.5 million downloads thanks to, wait for it, new gender swap and baby filters.
Have you tried these?
I think I have, actually. I think I was babyfied, which is kind of weird. A baby with a beard just does not work. As it's a woman with a beard, it's kind of strange. Sorry for anyone that's got a beard out there.
Yeah, they did it to me, and I look like a combination of all three of my brothers.
Well,
it's quite strange.
Good. I don't use Snapchat, but some of these filters are pretty funny. So I can see where, if they get a good filter, they're going to get decent traffic. But what does that mean? You know, so there's people using the filters. So what? They're not making any money, are they?
Well, when you swipe through all the different filters on the camera app, there are sponsored filters on there. So someone like Crunchy, if they've got a new Crunchy bar out, you'll have like a Crunchy filter that, you know, makes Crunchies pop around your face or whatever. So that's where the filter money comes in.
Every day's a school day on the Media Voices podcast.
I know, right?
Ah, Chris, you can stay in France. We're handling this.
And finally, publishers have actually been making some money off live video platform Twitch, which is primarily used for gamers. But I'm definitely going to save this one, Chris is back, because Twitch still boggles my mind. So as you may or may not know, we've got a growing transcript section on our website, thanks to Trint. If you go to voices.media/transcripts, you can see them all, and there's also a link to our dedicated email list that sends them out to you every Monday. Peter, who did you speak to this week?
This week I spoke with Rosie Fletcher, UK editor of Den of Geek. I asked her what actually is geek culture. She told me about how she used a time travel expert to get a fresh angle on the last Marvel movie.
That is not a job title.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
The guy's a time travel expert, yeah. He writes about time travel, yeah. She explained how Brexit has no place in friendly conversation online. But first, I asked her, what is Den of Geek?
Den of Geek is an entertainment website mainly focusing on movies, TV, games, and anything in geek culture, really. And it was founded in 2007. And part of the reason for how it was founded was it's kind of a reaction to, at the time, quite a lot of websites that were a bit snarky and a bit... sort of a bit mean and not necessarily safe spaces, and Den of Geek was made as a place that really celebrated geek culture, that didn't delight in deciding a film was going to be bad before it came out, but actually was just a place that that people who love geek culture and entertainment can come together, talk and celebrate that.
How do you define geek culture? That's a weird one.
Well, you know what? That is a weird one, and that's a really interesting question because actually, what geek culture was and what geek culture is isn't the same thing. So, geek culture now is pretty much anything. Well, it's not anything, but it's geek culture is mainstream culture now. So it isn't. Whereas once it might have been, considered a niche or a specialism. Now a lot of mainstream culture is, of course, what you would consider geek culture. I mean, we don't have a hard and fast definition. So while we do cover, things like comic book movies and sci-fi and horror, and that's a big part of us. We also cover a lot of things like British drama. So we'll cover Killing Eve and Line of Duty and Taskmaster and Peppa Pig. So I think it really is anything that somebody could really call themselves a fan of within that kind of popular culture sphere. I mean, the only things we don't really touch are, well, largely speaking, we don't touch reality. Although having said that, Taskmaster is kind of that. I guess that's a quiz, and we don't really touch soap operas.
So, like Love Island's huge at the moment, you wouldn't go near
Well, you say that. We wouldn't go near
that.
it except if we had a really geeky angle on it. So actually, a while ago, we did actually run an article on it, and the headline to the Den of Geek article was "Love Island Dystopian Breeding Camp or Romantic TV Idyll," which is yeah, it, which was a funny thought piece by one of our very best writers. So yeah, we do touch on things sometimes, but it has to be kind of in our way.
Right, so you need an angle on it. I mean,
Yes.
is it that idea that what maybe used to be comic culture, the kind of people that went to conventions for comics or Star Trek or whatever, but then that's kind of morphed into a much broader mainstream movement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, it was what I guess used to be called geek culture or nerd culture was something that that used to be a niche and now has become enormous. I mean, if you look at so there's so many conventions around the world, but if you look at something like particularly San Diego Comic-Con, which is the absolute epicenter of that kind of culture, and how it went from being essentially a comic convention to now being massively mainstream and attracting some of the biggest like talent, A-list talent working in the industry now, it's absolutely huge. So I mean, it's not niche culture anymore, but it's still fan culture.
Going back to that kind of Love Island thing, to the angle, how do you decide what your angle is?
So, Den of Geek's been around, for 12 years now, and I think it has quite a strong sort of USP and tone of voice. So, we'll always try and approach something in a way that others haven't. We're often quite irreverent, quite silly. We like stuff that's funny. We like stuff that's left field. So that article is just a. The guy who wrote it absolutely genuinely loves Love Island, but this is a much more kind of. It's a funnier, kind of interesting take on that sort of thing. So I mean, with most articles, we'll look at the big shows and the big games and the big films that we want to cover, but we'll try and think about it in a bit of a left field, and also often. Sort of, I guess, a more positive way than, rankings and, things and explainers and things like that. Although we do some of those, but yeah.
I'm thinking, so some of the stuff, as you've said, it's got bigger and bigger. Everyone's going to be covering it, so that from the newspapers to Digital Spy to magazines, men's magazines, women's magazines, everyone's going to have a take on these things, whether it's an Avengers movie or whether it's Love Island or whatever it is. So you've got to be, I guess you've got to be pretty focused to make sure that you're not just churning out stuff that everyone else has.
That you I mean you're absolutely right. That's so true. I mean, and the Marvel Cinematic Universe and of course Endgame is almost the biggest culmination of that. And we want to cover it and we want to serve it properly, but we don't want to just be the same as everyone else. And it is difficult, and it is a very crowded marketplace. So it isn't a case of just doing the same as everyone else. It's just trying to think of, I don't know, like original opinion pieces, or even just different kind of angles that are very us. So, for example, with Endgame, and if you haven't seen it, this is a bit of a spoiler, so maybe cover your ears. But if you haven't seen it, what are you thinking? I wanted to do an article on the rules of time travel within that film, And because when I watched it, I was confused and I was like, oh, I don't know exactly how this works. And I'm not saying that no other site would do that, but luckily I remembered a guy who I'd been at some kind of event who was a speaker who was kind of a time travel expert. So the article he wrote is so good and so intense, but it's like I would struggle to find anything more interesting and more comprehensive about that aspect and kind of explaining how that worked. So yeah, it's just trying to find a different way, and also to serve the readership, to make sure that we have something that's interesting and that you come away with something basically.
But does that come back to the talent that you can access, that you can find, the expert on time travel or the expert on something, that you've got to be very careful about who you're commissioning, if you like?
Yeah, well, so we have a pool of really good freelancers who we use, and a lot of them have specialisms and experts in things. And then, of course, but usually speaking, it was different with Chris, the time travel guy, because he's also a journalist. But sometimes we will use experts who are like, I don't know, a medical professional or something like that to do to bring in a different kind of angle. But yes, I mean, essentially to your original point, it's useful to have a nice strong pool of writers so I know who's good at what and who has the sort of specialist insider knowledge to be able to write something really comprehensive on a subject.
But if you're so the thing that's in the back of my mind, I guess, is something like Game of Thrones, which is just finished. And you're covering that for a period of time. I mean, I guess with Game of Thrones is a decade. Does something like that ending have a big issue? Does that cause you an issue?
Well, in the sense that when the series was ending, that obviously was a massive traffic spike for us. So in a way, that is potentially something that we no longer can rely on. We can't rely on spikes from Game of Thrones seasons. But I think like everybody's looking for the new Game of Thrones. Nobody really knows what's going to come along and become massive. So yeah, those big shows are really important to us. But we don't just rely on that. I mean, we have to make sure that we're covering all sorts of different things. And we get odd spikes from things that you wouldn't expect. So I mean, I mentioned like Line of Duty and Killing Eve. They both do really well for us. But also, so like obviously streaming services are coming out with a lot of new shows, and there's so much content coming out that it's very difficult to kind of you can't watch everything. But we did quite well from Russian Doll, for example, which was something that landed out of the blue. I just happened to binge it on the weekend, completely adored it, and wrote about that. So there will always be other things that crop up that will be kind of unexpected traffic drivers.
Right. So it's not about going hot and heavy on Game of Thrones and then all of a sudden going, oh my God, what are we going to
No, it is about going hot and heavy on Game of Thrones. Don't get me wrong, but then it's about looking at what's next. So I mean, I'm working on an article about Black Mirror right now.
Right.
I'm going to be writing something about a trend on Netflix to do with like a sort of pulp TV and its sort of resurgent popularity. So there'll be always, other things like so Good Omens, and then later in the year His Dark Materials. There'll be other big flagship shows. They might not be as big as Thrones, but I think it's about getting the right angle and tapping into things that people are talking about essentially.
So it's your job in that sense is to make sure you know what people is talking about rather than give them something new to talk about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I mean, that's not to say we don't publish interesting things that you wouldn't necessarily have occurred that wouldn't necessarily have occurred to you. But as a strategy in general, it is very useful to have a strong sense of what people are interested in, people are talking about. And of course, I mean that it makes it easier for us that all of the staff are also fans. So the things that people are talking about are the things that we are talking about, largely speaking. So yeah, whether that be some weird show that's just dropped on Netflix, or whether that be something as massive as Game of Thrones, you can quite easily get a sort of a sense, and also from social media as well, of the things that are like exciting people and that are buzzy. It's useful to be ahead of the curve though. So I think finding things that people don't necessarily know are amazing and flagging them up. So we'll do like lists of 30 films to watch next year, and within that list there'll be some obscure things that people wouldn't necessarily have on their radar. So I think it is important to have that as well.
So I guess it's that balance of about being geeky enough to actually have those conversations.
Absolutely.
And is that, you talk, I looking at the website for Denna Geek, More on the commercial side, actually, rather than the actual content. They're talking about having a hugely active audience and friendly comment boards. I love that. You've mentioned that friendly thing a couple of times, actually. Is that a big deal? Is it about being still about being a safe space for geeks?
Yeah, it's a massive deal, and it's extremely important to us. So, like, Den of Geek has a really active community, in a way that no other website that I have worked on has, and it's difficult, and it's super important to maintain that. Luckily, our comments boards are quite good at self-policing. So if somebody new turns up and is a bit horrible, because I can't spend all my day moderating comments boards, I do have a look, and I do try and get involved as I can, but it's just not practical. I can't 24/7 moderate, but it is. You'll often find that if someone comes in and is a bit mean, that another one of the users will gently say, "Rein it in, don't do that." I mean, I can't tell you it's always 100% civilized, but one of the nicest things is most of the time, most of the comments will be talking about the thing that the article is talking about. So, you know, we did a really lovely series in the lead up to Endgame, in fact, and it was called The Marvel Movies Debrief, and it was doing big in-depth looks at all of the 22 movies in the run-up, and 21 movies in the run-up, and the readers really liked it, but they also knew it was coming because it was regularly released, and were posting great big long, really lovely, really thought out critiques of these films that they'd clearly written beforehand, and it was great. It was super engaged, and just people really, you know, no one was kind of being mean about the article, and the articles were really good, but they were also just talking to each other and kind of enjoying talking about what they liked about films and what they didn't like. And I think, like, for us at Den of Geek, having that space for people to see something or love something or remember something or revisit something, and knowing they have like-minded people to talk to about it, is really what we're all about.
Well, what's the secret there, though? Because when you look at comments boards or forums on other publications, it's like this blasted wasteland of snark and vitriol.
Yeah.
So what's the secret? How can you help the rest of the publishing world solve this problem?
I you know what? I can't claim any credit for that, because I inherited the brand a year ago, and it was something that my predecessor, Simon, the founder, it was incredibly important to him. And I think that was... you know, that was really the kind of the USP, the point of the site in the first place. So I think he spent a lot of time kind of really carefully both moderating, cultivating, and kind of keeping this a safe space. But we also partly do it by not publishing things like, I don't know, 10 reasons why Hobbs and Shaw is going to be rubbish. Like, we would never write an article like that. Or if there's some kind of low budget indie that comes out and it's rubbish, we just won't review it, because what's right. The point of saying, oh, here's a film you've never heard of and it's rubbish? There's just no value in that. We just basically really try to avoid snark and really try to kind of cultivate that kind of community.
Does it ever go off on a tangent? Like,
all the time.
Well, Brexit is the one that do people go off and start chatting about Brexit?
A little bit, but that's not, not hugely. And I think that would be something that that I would probably discourage. Like, yeah. So there's been the odd time when it's been like, right, this is off topic and it's all getting a bit political. But I think, generally speaking, I think we try to sort of discourage that, because people will fall out about things that are not to do with the movie. And it's kind of like, stay on topic. This is an article about Doctor Who. Let's talk about Doctor Who, not about Brexit.
Does that... So one of the things that you do... I mean, obviously, you've got Den of Geek as a website, and it's there. But then you're also live on the social platforms, Facebook in particular. And does it still stay friendly on Facebook, or does it get a little bit different?
It isn't as friendly on Facebook. And also, we can't control that.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
You know, I can... If on Den of Geek, I can delete and I can moderate so I can't control that quite as much. It's not too bad, but the comment section on the actual website is the heartland of that, really.
Right, and are you using social platforms to get people back to your own property?
Well, actually, sometimes, but more and more we're producing kind of native content for both Twitter and Facebook, and I think it's people like to engage that way. So whether it's like exclusive clips that maybe for a film that isn't that huge, but the clip's nice, that we would then just natively post on Facebook, or, you know, memes or discussion points. You know, I think actually engaging with Facebook on Facebook is something that we are we're focused on at
so,
this point.
So is that more about brand awareness, or are you actually making some money from it?
Brand awareness, I would say. Yeah.
And then that community, which is clearly, from what you're saying, so engaged and friendly online, are you trying to get them into live events? Are you trying to get them out in the real world?
Yeah, we do, actually. So, again, one of the lovely things about this brand, and it's a lovely thing for me to have inherited, is that our readership do come to events. And when they say they come, they will come. So we've run various screening events. I did one quite early on, which was the Deadpool 2 Super Duper Cut. And I think we had a drop off of 3 people out of about 150, which is just phenomenal. So it's lovely to we have quite a complicated. We don't use a third party system to recruit people. We do it manually, which is a bit time consuming. But it just means that people turn up, and they're really nice people as well. So they turn up and they talk to you, and it's just becomes like a quite a nice sort of social thing. And that's something I think I'm keen to do more of, actually. Pushing forward, I'm keen to make sure we can engage with people face to face as much as possible, because it's lovely having such a kind of an engaged audience.
And is that, do you think that would be mostly screenings, or is there other stuff that you can do?
Well, there's other stuff we can do, but I can't give you too much detail at this point. But there are a couple of things that are in the pipeline that are likely to be happening this year. Events is something that we're really keen on, and I think would be a really good fit for our readership. So we're looking at interesting ways to bring content to life, put it that way.
I like that. Well, you do this, did you do the print special for, was it the London Comic Con?
Yes, so we've done, so it's 2 a year, so one in May and one in October.
But your background is print, yeah?
Yes. So I always enjoy doing that. Like, it's brilliant.
Is it like a little holiday?
Well, it's not a holiday, because obviously I've still got to run the website at the same time. But I cannot deny that I do love print. So doing those mags is something that, I absolutely love. There's a photograph of me on, I've changed my background on Facebook, and it's, we basically printed out all the pages A4 size and did a live flat plan on the carpet of the office. Yeah, and it's absolutely joyful. And I love the site, and I love working in digital. I've been in digital for 3 years now, just full-time digital. But I can't deny that it is quite nice to kind of dip back into the print stuff. I love things like cover design and layouts and flat plans, all that kind of stuff.
And do the print specials go down well at the conferences?
Oh, yeah, really well.
Are they conferences or conventions?
Conventions. They go down really well. The readers really love them. The PRs and the studios really love them, because I think there's always just a value to seeing something in print, and that's really, really beautiful. We get really great access because of that. So we had Dark Phoenix on our most recent cover, we had Shazam on the cover before that. Both of them were supported by cast and director interviews, which is just fantastic, and they were off junket, so it was all really lovely exclusive content. Obviously at the cons, queuing is a thing, crazy queuing, so much queuing. So it's really nice. I remember we were handing out mags at the last one, and we were giving out someone in an autograph queue, and the people were like, oh, where were you an hour ago? Because there's so much waiting around. They go down really well. It's a really nice thing to be able to do, really.
That's a great idea, though. If you've got loads of people queuing, just give them your print stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Captive audience. And also, it's really great for brand awareness. And we make sure that the mag really maintains the same tone of voice. So we'll have it still needs to be funny and irreverent and a little bit silly. I want the layouts to be gorgeous, but I want the content to still have Den of Geek's kind of unique personality.
Is it original content? You don't take stuff from online?
It is largely speaking original content. I think there was one feature which was an edited together piece based on the Marvel movies debrief, in fact. So it was the best scenes in all 22 of the movies. Right. But they were they were edited together from 22 other features. But largely speaking, mostly it's original content.
So the last question we always ask our guests is to tell us about a piece of media that they've loved recently, a book, a film, a podcast, whatever, to recommend to our listeners.
Okay. So I'm going to go with a podcast. So I'm quite an avid podcast listener, and like many people, I'm obsessed with true crime. I do love a murder podcast, and I listen to a lot of them, and a lot of them are really, really great. But there was one that I came across quite recently, which is absolutely brilliant, and it's called Root of Evil, or Root of Evil: The True Story of the Hodel Family and the Black Dahlia, and it's completely fascinating. It's told by the, I think it's the great granddaughters of a guy called George Hodel, who, as the podcast progresses, seems more and more likely to be the person who killed the Black Dahlia, which is just like crazy because the Black Dahlia case is obviously this like cold case from the 1940s in America, and you know it's never been solved. It was a woman named Elizabeth Short who was killed really, really horribly, and so these girls are sort of telling their family history, and it's, I mean, it's quite, you know, it's not quite dark, it's incredibly dark, so I will say, like, listener warning, particularly episode 5 is really tough, but like it's not, and it's not just about the murder, it's about their kind of whole family history, which, you know, there's all sorts of terrible things that went on. It's fascinating. And then of course at the end, well, not of course, but at the end there's a kind of element of family reunion which is really, really moving. So yeah, I love that. It's got everything. Can't recommend that highly enough. Root of Evil.
So, in case you hadn't heard, we have an email newsletter. Neil, I know we do. It's not new, but you maybe haven't heard about it. Just go to the website, voices.media, and sign up. And every week we will send you links to the stories we've talked about and some other cool stuff.
And all the stories we talk about on here and more are shared on our Twitter feed. So if you go to @MediaVoicesPod, that'll get you up to date with the latest, literally the cutting edge news media views.
And that's about it this week without Chris. Thank you so much for listening. He'll be back next week and we'll make him wear his Dubrovnik hat and we'll get a picture. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.